The sound of the deadbolt clicking into place is the loudest thing in my house. It's 6 p.m. on a Sunday. For the last 48 hours, the rooms have been hollow, smelling faintly of the lemon-scented floor cleaner I use when I'm trying to scrub the feeling of failure out of the linoleum. But now, the silence is gone. It's replaced by the heavy thud of two backpacks hitting the floor and the high-pitched, jagged whining of a 4-year-old who has been fed nothing but gummy worms and freedom for 2 days. This is the handoff. This is the moment I become the villain again. I stood in the entryway and watched my ex-husband's taillights disappear around the corner of the cul-de-sac. He was heading back to a condo that doesn't have laundry piles or unpaid utility bills taped to the fridge. He was leaving behind the weekend dad version of himself, the one who takes them to the zoo and lets them stay up until midnight watching cartoons. I am left with the default parent version of me, the one who has to explain why we can't have ice cream for dinner and why the iPad is stay at home only. I felt the familiar tightening in my chest, a physical constriction that makes it hard to take a full breath. My backbone felt like it was made of dry glass, ready to shatter if anyone leaned on me too hard. Behind the spice rack in the kitchen, tucked into the narrow gap between the wood and the wall, is a small black spiral notebook. It's my secret anchor. In it, I track every cent. $4 for a gallon of milk, $12 for the generic brand of fever reducer, 32 cents for the interest on the credit card I had to use to pay the electric bill. I keep it hidden because it's proof of a poverty that is as much psychological as it is financial. If anyone saw it, they'd see the math of a woman who is losing. But as long as it stays behind the cumin and the paprika, I can pretend I'm just being organized. It is the only place where I am allowed to admit that the numbers don't add up, no matter how many hours I put in at the firm. The house felt smaller than it did 20 minutes ago. My daughter Maya was already crying because her favorite stuffed rabbit was still in her father's back seat. My son Leo was staring at the pantry with the glazed look of a child who has had too much sugar and not enough sleep. I looked at the clock. It was 6:12 p.m. I had exactly 13 hours until the Monday morning school run began, and in that time, I had to wash 3 loads of clothes, pack 2 lunches, finish a marketing proposal, and convince 2 tiny humans that I wasn't the person who ruined their lives. The air in the kitchen was stagnant, smelling of the rainy pavement outside. I reached out and touched the cold, granite-look laminate of the counter. It's cheap, a temporary fix for a house that was never supposed to be our permanent home. I focused on the texture of it, the way the fake stone felt under my fingertips, trying to ground myself before the first scream. Every 5 days I survive, for 2 days I mourn. And on Sunday nights, the two versions of my life collide with enough force to leave bruises. The transition from the split was supposed to be collaborative. That's the word the mediator used. Collaborative. It sounds like a group project in a college marketing class. It doesn't sound like a woman sitting on the floor of a dark hallway at 2 a.m., trying to figure out if she can skip her own dental appointment to pay for her son's soccer cleats. It doesn't sound like the way my breath hitches when I see a blue truck that looks like his. Collaboration implies 2 people working toward a common goal, but the goal had shifted. His goal was to move on. My goal was to keep the ceiling from falling in. The trap isn't just the work. It's the optics. When he picks them up on Friday, he looks like a hero. He has the car seats buckled correctly and a bag of snacks ready. When he drops them off, he is rested. I am the one with the dark circles under my eyes and the frantic energy of someone who is always 5 minutes behind. The world looks at him and sees a dedicated father. The world looks at me and sees a struggling single mother, a category that carries a faint scent of pity and inevitable burnout. I am the one who manages the pediatricians, the teacher conferences, the shoe sizes, and the social-emotional development. He is the one who manages the fun. I opened the fridge. There was half a carton of eggs and a wilted head of lettuce. The notebook behind the spice rack told me I couldn't go to the store until Tuesday. I felt a surge of resentment, so sharp it felt like a physical sting. I looked at Maya, who was still sobbing on the floor, and for a split second, I didn't see my daughter. I saw a physical manifestation of the man who left. I saw his stubborn chin and his refusal to listen. I saw the reason I was trapped in this suburban cage while he was out reinventing himself. I hated myself for seeing it, and I hated him for making it possible. The sensory shift hit me then. The smell of Leo's sweaty hair as he leaned against my leg. The sound of the rain starting to drum against the vent hood over the stove. I reached down and pulled Maya into my lap. She smelled like the expensive laundry detergent his girlfriend uses. It's a scent that makes me feel like an interloper in my own child's life. I held her until the sobbing turned into those long, shuddering breaths that happen at the end of a tantrum. I didn't say anything. I couldn't. Anything I said would have been a lie, and I was too tired to perform. By 9 p.m., the house was finally quiet again. The kids were asleep in beds that I had paid for with the emergency savings account I wasn't supposed to touch. I sat at the kitchen table with my laptop open, the blue light reflecting off the surface of the notebook I'd pulled out from behind the spices. I had $14, $12 in my checking account. The proposal was only half finished. If I didn't get it done, the firm would start looking at my reduced productivity as a liability. They were supportive at first, but support has an expiration date, especially when it involves missed meetings because of a recurring ear infection. The practical consequence of speaking up, of demanding a real 50-50th split of the labor, not just the visits, was a legal battle I couldn't win. He had a better lawyer. He had more family support. If I pushed too hard, he'd go for full custody, not because he wanted to do the work, but because he didn't want to pay the support. I knew the game. I'd seen it played a dozen times in the suburbs. The woman who complains is unstable. The woman who asks for help is overwhelmed. So I stayed silent, and I let the burnout hollow me out from the inside. I looked at the miscellaneous column in my ledger. It was empty. There is no room for miscellaneous in this life. Everything must be categorized. Everything must have a purpose. I realized then that I wasn't just tracking money. I was tracking my own worth. If the numbers stayed even, I was a good mother. If they dipped into the red, I was failing. It was a brutal binary way to live, but it was the only metric I had left that felt objective. The hum of the refrigerator felt like a vibration in my teeth. I closed the laptop and put my head in my hands. I couldn't admit to anyone that I was beginning to dread the sound of the car in the driveway on Sundays. I couldn't admit that I fantasized about driving in the opposite direction, past the grocery store, and the school, and the rental office, until the radio stations changed, and no one knew my name. I was a mother, and mothers don't run. We endure. We find our backbone in the very moments we think we are breaking, because we don't have the luxury of falling apart. One thing I still cannot say aloud is that I am waiting for him to fail. I am waiting for the weekend where he forgets the snacks or misses the pickup, just so I can feel justified in my anger. I am hoarding his small mistakes like treasures, keeping a mental tally that matches the one in my hidden notebook. It's a toxic, bitter way to survive, but it keeps me upright. It's the fuel that gets me through the 3 a.m. laundry and the 7 a.m. commute. The next morning, the sun was a pale, watery yellow. I was standing at the counter, cutting the crusts off sandwiches, when Leo asked me why Dad doesn't have a chore chart at his house. I felt the glass in my spine crack a little more. I explained that different houses have different rules. My voice calm and measured, even as I wanted to scream. I packed the lunches, found the missing sneaker, and got them into the van with 3 minutes to spare. Trial by fire isn't a single event. It's a daily recurrence. It's the constant heat of necessity. As I drove toward the school, I looked at myself in the rearview mirror. I looked like a woman who was in control. My hair was brushed, my shirt was ironed, and my voice was steady. But I saw the woman behind the spice rack. I saw the one who counted the pennies. I saw the one who was holding the fragments of a broken life together with nothing but sheer, desperate will. I was the default parent, the one who stayed when the world got heavy, and that made me both a hero and a prisoner. The day at the office was a blur of spreadsheets and forced smiles. I ate my lunch at my desk, a sandwich made from the eggs and the wilted lettuce. I watched my colleagues talk about their weekends, trips to the lake, quiet mornings with coffee, movies they'd actually finished. I felt like a spy from a different country, someone who spoke the language but didn't understand the culture of leisure. My leisure was a 40-minute window after the kids were in bed, before I collapsed into a dreamless sleep. When I picked them up from after-school care, Maya was holding a drawing she'd made. It was a picture of a house with two doors. She told me it was so she could go between my house and Daddy's house without having to go outside. I felt a lump in my throat that tasted like copper. I was trying to protect their belief that the world was still whole, but they already knew the truth. They were living in the pieces, just like I was. I put the drawing in my passenger seat and told her it was beautiful. We got home, and the cycle began again. The bags on the floor, the whining, the search for the missing toy. I went to the kitchen and reached for the notebook. I needed to see the numbers. I needed to know where I stood. But as I pulled it out, it slipped from my hand, and the pages fanned out on the floor. All the columns of milk and diapers and interest rates were laid bare under the harsh kitchen light. I stared at them, and for the first time, I didn't feel shame. I felt a cold, hard clarity. This wasn't a failure. It was a record of endurance. Every entry was a day I hadn't quit. Every subtraction was a problem I had solved. I wasn't breaking. I was being forged. The backbone I thought was glass was actually something much stronger, something that had been tempered in the heat of a year. I never thought I'd survive. I picked up the notebook and put it back behind the spices. I didn't need it to tell me who I was anymore. I walked into the living room where Leo was struggling with a puzzle. He was frustrated, trying to force a piece into a spot where it didn't fit. I sat down on the floor next to him. I didn't fix it for him. I just sat there. I told him that sometimes you have to look at the pieces differently. Sometimes the piece you think is missing is just under the rug, or in a different box entirely. He looked at me, his eyes wide and trusting, and for a moment, the resentment vanished. But the moment was brief. The reality of the week ahead was still there, waiting. I had 4 days of solo parenting left before the next handoff. 4 days of being the heavy, the rule maker, the one who carries the mental load of 3 people. I looked around the rental, at the boxes I still hadn't unpacked because I wasn't sure if we were staying. I realized that staying silent was the only way to keep the peace, but the peace was a lie. It was a fragile, expensive mask that I was paying for every single day. The silence of the house after they go to bed is supposed to be a relief, but tonight it felt like an accusation. It reminded me of everything I hadn't said to their father during the handoff. I hadn't told him that Maya cried for 3 hours. I hadn't told him that I was nearly broke. I hadn't told him that I was drowning. I kept the secret because I didn't want him to have the satisfaction of knowing he'd won. But in the silence, I wondered if I was the one who had actually lost. I stood by the window and looked out at the street. The rain had stopped, leaving the pavement shiny and black. A car drove by, its headlights sweeping across the room, illuminating the half-packed boxes and the toys on the rug. For a second, the room looked like a stage set, something temporary and hollow. I wondered if I would ever feel like I was living in a real home again, or if I was destined to always be in transition, always figuring out the pieces of a puzzle that would never be complete. The practical consequence of staying silent is that nothing changes. He continues to be the hero of the weekends, and I continue to be the exhausted ghost of the work week. The world continues to revolve around his convenience, while I am the one who makes the orbit possible. I realized that my backbone wasn't just for me. It was the pillar holding up a system that was designed to break me. And as long as I kept standing, the system would keep pressing. I went to the kitchen and turned off the light. The spice rack was a dark silhouette against the wall. I knew the notebook was there, and I knew the numbers hadn't changed. I still had $14. 12. I still had a half-finished proposal. I still had a daughter who wanted a rabbit that was 40 miles away. The devastation wasn't in the split itself, but in the quiet realization of what survival actually looked like. It wasn't a triumph. It was just a series of small, exhausting choices made in the dark. I walked down the hallway to my bedroom, stepping over a plastic dinosaur and a stray sock. I lay down in the bed that always felt too big and too cold. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine a version of tomorrow where I wasn't afraid, but the image wouldn't come. Instead, I just heard the sound of the rain starting up again, a rhythmic, persistent tapping that sounded like someone counting. Milk, diapers, interest, hours, minutes, seconds. I waited for sleep to take me, but it was a long time coming. I lay there in the quiet, a woman with a backbone of glass, waiting for the sun to come up so I could start the survival all over again.